Good morning and welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. Well, thousands of Alaska kids qualify for Medicaid, which provides the much-needed benefit of covering mental health services for a very vulnerable population in our community. Drug abuse, domestic violence, and poverty rates are all very high in Alaska and impact a wide array of young people, regardless of socioeconomic status. This includes a disproportionate number of children who are supported by Alaska Medicaid. When parents fortunate enough to have private insurance have a child who starts to exhibit signs of depression or anxiety, is failing in school and acting out with anger and defiance, or has experienced some kind of traumatic event, they have the option of calling around to a variety of private clinics or using a name of someone they got from a friend or a school counselor in an effort to find help for their child. A problem arises, however, for the parents of children who receive Medicaid. When they try to access mental health services for their child who may be experiencing the very same issues as their privately insured peers, what they find is that most private clinics and small groups of providers cannot charge Medicaid for their services, and the places who do accept Medicaid are community-based mental health clinics with sometimes a 6 to 9 month waiting list or even more just to be seen by a therapist who they have really no part in choosing. Why is this situation happening to our children in our community? Is it fair? Is it legal? What would happen if all the children who needed services received them? How much would it cost? And what might the long-term savings be, both financially and from a community health perspective? Joining me today for what I think has evolved into a three-part series on Medicaid, children and mental health, is Dr. Michelle Laufer from the Alaska Center for Pediatrics. Welcome to the show. Thanks, Prentice. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We'd love to hear from listeners today. This is a show that might generate some interest, I hope, because I think it's something that's important to our community as a whole. We'll get into some of the numbers and why this is significant. And today I kind of want to, I hope we outline sort of the scope of the problem, what pediatricians, which is why Dr. Laufer is here, what are they seeing in their clinics? What are the challenges of making these referrals? These are people who come to them for trust and with trust and for advice that they can believe. And sometimes it seems like hands are tied. So we'll hear from Dr. Laufer more on that. Please do call in if you've had an experience with Medicaid or trying to find services. That'd be great to hear from listeners. If you're a physician or a provider or who's frustrated as well, please call in and share some of that with us. There's three ways to call us. 550-8433 is our Anchorage phone number. If you're outside of Anchorage, we have a toll-free number, which is 1-888-353-5752. The last way to reach us is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right. I guess let's start off with some of the numbers. In Medicaid, we looked at, I just did a whole bunch of research on what are the numbers of children in Medicaid, and we have about 98,000 kids in Medicaid. Represents about 32% of the children in Alaska are covered by Medicaid or through the CHIP program, which is, what is that, Dr. Laufer? The Child
Health Improvement.
Right, is sort of an extension of Medicaid to cover some of those. I mean, it seems like Medicaid expansion is really doing a good service towards trying to include more people and access to these services, but they're not getting access. So we have 98,000 kids in Alaska with Medicaid. We know from the youth risk behavioral surveys that have been conducted for years and years here by, Department of Health and Social Services in conjunction with UAA. I believe somebody can call and correct that. But what we know is that about 30% of kids in Alaska suffer some significant diagnosable mental health problem in a given year. And we know that in schools that have a higher, the charter schools, the outside schools that aren't of the mainstream Anchorage School District, their numbers are closer to 40%. And that's disproportionately lower income and Medicaid folks. So that's sort of the scope of the problem. And these are the folks we'll get into now. Dr. Laufer, I guess let's start on your end. Like, what are you seeing in your office? You reached out to me, right? You called or sent me an email and said, what can I do? What can we do about this? What was the impetus for that phone call, and what are you seeing that triggered it?
Right. So in our office, Alaska Center for Pediatrics, we see about 40% of our patients are covered by Medicaid. So that's, you know, a number of kids in a day who I see who are covered by Medicaid. And certainly, at least on a daily basis, we have children who in whom we identify mental health care needs. And the very first question when I am with a patient, because I often don't know what their insurance is I look and I see what is their health care coverage. And if it's Medicaid, I know that our options for hooking that child and family up with services are limited. Our office is a little bit different in that as a patient-centered medical home with an owner, Dr. Woodard, who used to be the host of this show, who really values treating a whole child, we have a licensed clinical social worker on staff. And so she sees our children, mostly covered by Medicaid. About 65% of the kids she sees in our office are covered by Medicaid, basically, you know, for free. I mean, that is covered by the overhead of the clinic,
right?
Because that is willing to do that. A few years ago, for 1 year, her salary was covered by a grant from the Alaska Mental Health Trust, but that grant was not extended. So we do have her, and often what she'll do is see kids and families sort of in the interim while we're waiting to hook that child up with longer-term services. However, if the needs are beyond that, if we have complex psychiatric needs, our options are very limited, and primarily we send them to the South Central Foundation, where the families, we are not allowed to make an appointment. They have to walk in. So we basically give them an address and a piece of paper and say, go here and get online to speak with an intake worker and see if you can be served there.
Okay, so back to the grant real quick. You guys, well, Dr. Woodard, let's start with that. He is probably an exception to the rule in his clinic and how he operates. And those who've listened to his show for years know that he's always advocated for mental health coverage as the primary, and then you can add like medical health coverage. That's been, he's like, that is the thing that drives so much of the medical problems and the, you know, the dysfunction and the substance abuse, which is, and the bad habits which create heart disease and diabetes and all the things that you guys fight to put back together, right? So Dr. Woodard's a big prevention, intervention, family systems, whole child person. And that's great, but it comes at a great cost. And I don't think everybody has that sense of responsibility to the community. And I mean, that's a tough pill for many people to swallow. So the grant was to get some funding for that. Why did it get lost? Why did they choose not to?
I don't know. My understanding is that it was anticipated that it would continue, but it did not. So I don't know.
Probably along with budgetary cuts and all the other service and things that are considered kind of ancillary, right? And, or extras. All right. So that's the, what's the process if somebody comes in? I kind of did a little outline here, 'cause if a child comes in and he's having, little Timmy comes in and he's having behavior problems and he's acting out in school and withdrawing and playing too many video games and he's angry and he's got Blue Cross, how does it initial feeling for you? Like, oh.
Right. So that question, when we identify a need and then the first thing we do is look at what the insurance coverage is. So again, for the child covered by Medicaid, I'm going to hook them up with Jessica in my office.
Yeah.
I'm going to determine if they need medication management. Is it a medication that I am comfortable prescribing? And as a pediatrician, I'm limited in my scope of what I'm comfortable doing with that. Some pediatricians will do more or less. So that child on Medicaid will be hooked up with Jessica, and then we will, you know, basically put them on a wait list to see a child psychiatrist when that's available, which is often, again, 6 months, a year, and longer. If the child has private insurance, we can generally get them in. You know, we call your office, we call one of the mental health offices, we look at our list of people who we know see children with X, Y, or Z problem, and we call and we try and get them in. We can usually get them in with a psychiatrist in a reasonable, you know, sometimes, you know, there's a national shortage of psychiatrists.
Yeah.
So medication management is another issue, but that is not specific in this situation to Medicaid, children on Medicaid. But it is harder with children on Medicaid. But even for, you know, an insured child, it's hard to get in with a psychiatrist. It's a wait. So the difference is, we have care coordinators, and I turn to my friend Molly, my care coordinator. I say, Molly, where can this child, she starts to call around and she says, where can we get this child in soonest? What's the wait list now? Because it's also a moving target. So that child with Blue Cross has many, many more options. Even if there's, you know, a wait to see you, Prentice, you can tell me, oh, look, the guy down the hall or another guy I know can see them soon.
Right. So, I mean, if you have private insurance, then we're talking about Counseling Solutions of Alaska and Bridges Counseling Connection and Office of Human Relations and all these other little clinics and
Independent providers.
And independent providers, which there are hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
So you're private, and they've often got referrals from teachers or friends. So they're going to somebody. And I don't know if, like, anybody who's taken their kid to a therapist knows how, like, hard that is and stressful and how much anxiety it provokes for a parent. And then to know that you're going to somebody that your friend saw is really an ease for a lot of folks. Like, oh, I hear it all the time. Oh, my friend's kid saw you and mm-hmm. said, so I feel really good, you know, about that. But you don't know who you're going to see when you wait for 9 months and then you get plugged into somebody. They may be great. They may be green. They may not. I mean, just mailing it in. I don't know. It's sort of, but you don't get to choose. That's the point.
And it's the same with when we tell people to walk over to South Central Foundation. What prompted me to email you a few weeks ago was when I was following through with the plan I always do, which is, you know, your needs are beyond what we can do here. Here is your resource. We need you to walk in over there, go wait in the line, see the intake worker. And they were turned away after the intake. And I still don't understand why they were turned away. So I just threw my hands. What are we supposed to do for this family who is really looking for resources for their child who has ADHD, among other issues? You know, super common, occurs in 10% of kids, very limited, you know, resources. And, you know, what's the next step? And that is my question. What is the next step?
Yeah, and that's what hopefully we're going to get into more in a later program. We have a call out to the Disability Law Center of Alaska, and then they hooked us up with a lady out of D.C. who does national health law, I think, and to look at some of this, like, is it really okay? Is it, how did we get to this point? And who's making these decisions for Medicaid about who is qualified to see? These are the questions that I really want to get answered, and hopefully somebody from Medicaid will come on and talk as well. We certainly will put that out there. You mentioned something. We got about 5 minutes before the break, and I'd like to cover this. It's a little bit of a sensitive issue because as a doctor, I mean, you're charged with giving the best care, and part of the, you were mentioning before we came on the air, the guidelines is that you're supposed to ask about ACEs. Can you talk about ACEs and what you're supposed to ask and what kind of position that puts you in as a doctor for a child?
Right. And we have this debate. I mean, so it's recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics that we, you know, screen families for ACEs, adverse childhood events, which have health implications, you know, poverty, mental illness in the family, substance use in the family,
domestic violence,
inadequate food. So all of these things are tied to poor, and the more of those things you have, the more likely that child is going to have health and mental and behavioral health issues.
Right. There's a direct correlation. I mean, a line from the number of exposures to adverse childhood experiences, which is the ACEs, and the number of mental health problems as an adult. That's been sort of established through long-term studies.
So we ask, because as Dr. Woodard always says, and is 100% true, most of what I do as a pediatrician is not what you think of a doctor doing, prescribing something, you know, sending you to the hospital. Most of what we do is educating parents about normal, healthy development, what to expect from your children, you know, appropriate parameters to set, and when to worry, right? So if we identify, all right, we need to worry a little here. You know, this kid is out of the realm of normal. We need to hook up services to help the family and the child, either with, you know, attention problems, ADHD, school problems, depression, anxiety. If we are out of the realm of normal, we need to hook you up. So we're asking people questions and we're identifying problems for which we are very limited in our ability to help. And that, you know, that is really frustrating to a lot of us who do this on a daily basis, and which is most pediatricians and many family practice doctors.
Yeah, that is you're absolutely right. And it is, the guidelines are to ask these questions because it's felt that it's so important that these be identified and that we treat these, not just so that they're identified, right?
Well, it's like, oh, you have diabetes, but we will not give you any insulin.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, but there's only two insulin clinics that will take your insurance, and so you can't get it for 9 months.
Right.
But we'll try some other things.
Right.
And, with fruit
and
juice.
And the research shows, and there was a great talk on this last week at the All Alaska Pediatric Partnership meeting about how the earlier we can help a child, obviously, who's undergone these stressors, the better we can affect their outcome.
Early identification, which is the asking of the questions, which is new. And, you know, because that's a tough conversation to have, not only for a doctor, especially if you don't have resources, but for the clients. And they're off. It's a lot of vulnerability to talk about what's going on at home. And to get that out and to have them trust you that much. And then you look at them and say, well, yeah, I'm sorry I had to ask, but this is what you get.
Yeah.
And it's got to rip your heart out.
Yeah. We have, you know, at our office meetings about our provider meetings about this, there's a lot of different opinions among the providers who's comfortable asking this, who, you know, at every visit, who should ask, when should we ask? Because some people are offended. Some people are like, that has nothing to do with my medical care because they don't see that as medical. But we know that it's a huge part of a child's health.
All right. Being the initial point of contact, what do you see, like, I mean, you're having to manage this, right? You mentioned earlier, and I wanted to get back to that a little bit more, medications for depression, medications for ADHD, the scope of practice. So not only does it put you guys in a bind personally from having to ask these questions, and then once you identify it, then you know it's a problem, you have to do something, right? And the management that you guys can do once every month or 2 months that you see them, and maybe some visits with Jessica that are pro bono, isn't enough, is it?
Well, I mean, it's not ideal. It's sort of what we, I think we all do our best. And different, you know, families, schools, teachers, specifically with ADHD, as many people as we can involve, you know, we can develop 504 plans and whatever we can do to help that child be successful. But it definitely, in the treatment of ADHD, it's recommended that we don't just medicate, but that we also provide behavioral interventions. And for a child on Medicaid, you know, that's very hard to, at this point, to provide. So, we do some training in our office, and Jessica meets with families. But in terms of going to someone like you or someone at Psychology Resources and, helping a child work through and the family work through managing their hyperactive child, that's not available.
Okay. Well, we are we're at our 20-minute break, so... I think what we'll do is we'll go ahead and take a little bit early. We're discussing, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Michelle Laufer. She's with the Alaska Center for Pediatrics, and we are discussing the challenges faced by Alaska Medicaid families in accessing needed psychological services for their children. If you have a question or comment about today's topic, an experience you'd like to share, please don't hesitate to call in or email. As always, you can reach us in three ways. The local phone number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free from anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org, and I will get them read on the air. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation. I'm Prentice Pemberton. This is Line 1, your health connection.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org. Premier of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska reminds residents that open enrollment for individual and family health plans is now through December 15th. KFF studies indicate the average 2017 tax credit for eligible Alaskans was over $700 a month. Enroll at premera.com. This message sponsored by Premier of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning into the program, my guest today is Dr. Michelle Laufer with the Alaska Center for Pediatrics. We are discussing the challenges that are faced by Alaska Medicaid families when they need psychological services, in particular what pediatricians are seeing in their offices, what challenges they're facing with making referrals, because it's a big problem to get a large number of kids seen in our community that could really benefit. If you missed part of today's conversation, you can catch the rebroadcast of Line 1 tonight at 8. You can find it on our podcast, and you can check out the archives at alaskapublic.org. Just go to the homepage, click on the radio tab, and scroll down to Line 1. If you click on that, then you can look at all the past shows and look at what kind of topics might interest you, or just browse for things that grab you. I want to remind listeners, questions and comments are welcome. Addition on our program, especially today, we'd like to hear from you about any experiences you've had trying to navigate through and get services for yourself or your family. I know it's not just a kid problem. Dr. Laufer, you were talking about families before and parents and how important that is as well to the children's health. We can't just treat these kids in a vacuum, right?
Right, and we start screening parents for, moms especially, but also sometimes dads for depression, you know, at our first postpartum visit, and we screen them throughout, especially in a child's early childhood. And for many families, as adults, we're not very good at going to the doctor. I mean, if you're pregnant, you go to the doctor, and, you know, if you get sick, you go to the doctor.
Right.
But a lot of our families and parents, kind of their only contact with the medical community is through our office and bringing their child to the doctor. And so we try and help identify specifically mental health, issues in parents and moms, and hook them up with resources. Providence has a nice postpartum depression clinic,
right,
and treatment there, or we refer them back to their own caregiver. But we are trying to support the parents and their own mental health, because parenting is hard. I mean,
yeah,
parenting is stressful. And especially if you have a child with a behavior problem or a mental health problem, that can be really isolating and part of the support of the child is supporting the parent. And some of what we just do is tell them, yeah, like, you know, it sucks. You have a kid who's really hard.
Yeah.
Because their friend next door.
Validating.
Yeah. I mean, their friend is raising their kid and doesn't have any of these problems. And you've got this kid who you can't get out the door and is bouncing off the wall, or who's super depressed and hiding in their room.
Screaming at you.
Yeah. So, we do a lot of treatment of families, and certainly having a parent with a mental illness or is one of those ACEs, is a risk factor for children.
And that's often common in low-income families and poverty and that cycle of historical trauma that goes generational.
Yeah, because poverty is stressful.
Is stressful,
and
yes.
You can't get to your appointment because you have to walk to the bus, and then you have to wait in the cold, and your kid forgot their jacket.
Yeah.
So, you know, parenting is hard enough in the best of circumstances. But when you have other, you know, not enough food or, you know, three jobs, and you have to get your kid from daycare to this or that, or you have to go wait in line at the Medicaid office, whatever.
Then you're single.
It's even, yeah. Yeah, you're
single.
And
you got to go get food at the pantry.
Right.
I mean, there's lots of hardships that people I don't know. I mean, just take it for granted, many of us. So let's go. We got a couple of phone calls starting to come in, which is great, especially on this topic today. So let's go with Gunnar and Fairbanks. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Good morning. So my name's Gunnar Ebbeson, and this is a very important issue for me. I actually own a for-profit clinic in Fairbanks, and I don't take Medicaid.
Okay.
And the reason I don't take Medicaid is there are several. So one of the incredible problems with providing mental health services for folks on Medicaid at the master's level, so these are master's level therapists, is the paperwork burden that Medicaid has and puts on clinicians.
Yeah.
So in any nonprofit that you work in as a mental health clinician, you're spending 40 to 60% of your time doing paperwork. And the converse amount of time seeing patients. So a typical caseload in the places that I know of, especially like, for example, Fairbanks Community Mental Health Center, is around 14 to 18 people a week, and they are working more than 40 hours to accomplish this. The behavioral health assessments alone take 4 to 6 hours to complete. And so this is the initial intake that a person would have to go through in order to, you know, start to receive services, identify the problems, and start to develop solutions. In many cases, because agencies have their own electronic health record, they're also required to do double entry and put in a basic set of data into AK Ames, which is the state database. So basically, they're having to type out this onerous behavioral health assessment and then, you know, spend another 30 minutes to 45 minutes putting in data into another system. So that's just the beginning, right? So then the treatment planning, client service reviews or the CSRs, functional assessments that are required. I worked at community mental health for years, and I got out of it specifically because it just wasn't an efficient system. And so where I work, you know, my clinicians see, they're required to see at least 24. Many of them see 30 a week.
Right.
And they're happy. So I have happy clinicians, and that makes good clinicians and good services. So to me, that I've been a proponent of changing that. So a really interesting fact that people don't recognize that physicians don't have to do this. So physicians, when they see a patient and they develop a progress note and a plan, it's typically done in one or two pages at the most. But for master's level clinicians, it's this onerous thing. I remember a guy coming in. He worked at one of the hospitals in Juneau. And he brought a cancer patient file in that was like a 3-year cancer patient file in, and then a 1-year behavioral health file in. And the cancer patient's was probably about 1/4 inch thick. the behavioral health client's file was an inch or an inch and a half thick.
Yeah.
And it's, that's just not parity. So that's one thing. If you have any questions about that, I'm willing to stay and talk about it.
No, health parity is health parity, and that is what that's what we're going to be talking about on a later show, is what is health parity? What does that mean? Is it the right, if you have these benefits, that you access them? But let me ask you a question, Gunnar, because you're in exactly the same position that I am in as a mental health clinic owner who has, 13 or 14 therapists, and I have nurse practitioners who can bill Medicaid for medicine. So I have nurse practitioners. They don't have to have a psychiatrist on site. They can bill Medicaid, but then I can't partner with my nurse practitioners to do therapy with these kids that they're seeing once a month to provide medicine for an 8-year-old who's got behavioral problems. So that's, I agree with you. And the paperwork. I also worked at Community Mental Health Center in Wasilla, and then at Good Sam when it was open, and we did all the Medicaid kids. And it was a killer to run through those treatment plans and to update them every 90 days and do the objectives and the goals. And then you always have, which you didn't mention, Medicaid hanging over your head to come back in and do an audit. And then if you don't have your T's crossed and your I's dotted, you get to pay it all back.
Yeah. So what I call that is predatory auditing. When the auditor,
right.
These are outside auditors that get a percentage of what they find, they're allowed to use extrapolation. Like, who
yes.
on earth in their right mind starting a business would do that? It just doesn't make any sense.
No, we don't. My question to you then is, if Medicaid came up with similar outlines, similar rules to as Blue Cross Aetna, that you do a basic intake, you do your follow-up notes, you give a diagnosis, and you provide good care for a reasonable rate of, you could cut Medicaid a deal, but would you do that with your providers?
Without question.
I would too. And I think it's needed. We already good percentage.
We are in a current, budget deficit. We're talking about, like, we're always fighting every year for, we could in a one fell swoop, in my opinion, by getting rid of some of these, like, these are not evidence-based practices. There's no evidence to support that these extensive treatment plans and BHAs increase client care. And if there is, please send them to me.
I'd love to see it too, because I haven't found it.
And so why we talk about evidence-based practice, why do we continue to do this? Part of it, the answer to that question is part of it's federal. So some of these are federal requirements, but I think it's the state interpretation of those requirements that needs to change. And I'm nationally accredited through CARF. I have to do treatment planning and all this stuff, but it is not, like, it is nowhere near what Medicaid is. And there's no reason for it. I want to say too that, some of the things, practices that are happening in the state, you really hit, an important, issue for me about the constitutionality of some of these practices. For example, children right now in Fairbanks are being stuck in the ER for days on end.
Yeah.
So these are padded rooms with nothing in there, with their family setting up camp in these rooms for days on end, waiting for psychiatric services. I think that is that is not okay by any stretch. So you have these kids that come in. They're actively suicidal or gravely disabled. And if you sit them in a room like that long enough, they're going to say, fine, I'm not suicidal.
Correct.
Right? I mean, it's insane. And then on the positive side, I really think that Josh Arvidson with the Child Trauma Center does amazing work with trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's a large wait list, but he's through Community Mental Health, or they are through Community Mental Health, and they are in a nationally watched program through people like Bessel van der Kolk.
Right.
They are part of his network.
And I met
and
him.
So that's a really great resource.
I met him last week at this, and he gave a great talk, he and two other people who are involved in this, with regards to you know, I said to him, what do I do with these kids? And he said, well, we're here. And I said, well, how do I,
we're here for
how
you.
Do I get the kids to you? You know, and he gave me, you know, a number to call, and I'm going to call and try and figure this out. I mean, those kids have to meet a certain, you know, degree of
trauma.
They have to be severely emotionally disturbed.
Right.
So this would not be your typical ADHD or even, you know, depression or anxiety kid. These kids have severe disturbances, but I was really pleased to hear his talk, and he was very kind and came over and spoke with me after, and we did talk about that. So there is, I understand, even potentially the possibility that we could directly refer a child to them rather than telling mm-hmm. someone to go walk in and stand in the waiting room and wait, you know, so that you can maybe be. So I, yes, I appreciate you bringing him up, because I think that is a resource that I was not aware of. And this is part of the problem. This whole thing is a moving target. And I've been a pediatrician up here for 17 years. And I feel like I have almost, you know, I would hope someone calls up and tells me I'm wrong, that maybe there are more resources that I don't know about. But we need some means of disseminating this information so that pediatricians and family docs and folks know, you know, where are the services, you know, that he's out there. Is there a way to refer kids to him? And he has some federal money, I think, and such. But thank you for bringing that up.
So somewhere out there right now is the director for the United Way, and who I interviewed a couple weeks ago, who's screaming right now, Alaska 211, right? That's the information, what I've understood. Mm-hmm. And this gives me a thought to really do maybe a half hour on resources and have 211 and United mm-hmm. Way come in and talk about all of these things for our lower income folks and the people. And part of the problem, I think Gunnar pointed out, and one of the things that I found, is these are the folks without a voice, the ones who need it the most. And Gunnar, the word I've been using is classism, right? It mm-hmm. is about those with means and those without.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And those of us in the field, those are the folks that we want to serve. Like,
absolutely.
We want to serve everybody, right?
Because they're going to wind up in jail.
Everybody's equal, and some are more equal than others, you might, you know, from Animal Farm. But
Gunnar, do you find the law regarding the requirement that there be a psychiatrist 30% of the time in your clinic, is that limiting your acceptance?
That crushed Fairbanks.
Yeah.
That crushed Fairbanks. So we, because of the very tight budgetary line that community mental health centers run on, there were some issues with our community mental health. They actually shut down some 4 or 5 years ago. And then, so that wiped that out until Anchorage Community Mental Health Services came in and took over a couple years later, which was a long spool up. But we had another center in town, which was Fairbanks Counseling and Adoption, and they had been providing Medicaid services forever for children, and they were another referral source in this town. And so that the physician there had been working herself to the bone for 100 years. I know her very well. And she finally said, I can't go in on Saturdays anymore and work. And bless her heart, right? And so, but as soon as she quit doing that, they lost the ability to provide those services. And I think that just doesn't make sense at all. And the other part that doesn't make sense is that only LCSWs can bill in private practice to Medicaid. And
you mean the LMF
doesn't make sense?
The LMFTs?
You got LMFTs and LPCs, right? So it's actually already been passed that they're allowed to, so in legislation, but the state is sitting on that. They're deciding not to move. There's a lobby against it that exists because there are people that feel that if all of a sudden private practitioners all over the state are taking Medicaid, that somehow they're not going to have their census are going to go down. It drives me batty. Because there is no reason why the level, they talk about level of training or whatever, you know, the difference between licensures is...
It's minimal.
It's nonsensical.
It's nonsensical, really. It's
of
no consequence.
It's a lobby thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a lobby thing. So anyway, I know I've taken a lot of your time. I really appreciate
it. Was good
it.
Information. And, great call. I appreciate it. Thank you. Let's talk again, because I think we're on the same team. All right, go quickly to John. He's been waiting a long time. John, you're in Fairbanks, or that's Tristan? Oh, John, you're in Fairbanks. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I believe that the issue is not so much a class issue as much as it is a money and efficiency issue. I believe that unwittingly our government has made so many policies, rules, and regulations, and they're sort of the iron fist comes through Medicaid and Medicare, and that translates into electronic medical record. My mate's children were taken into a pediatrician for a very routine situation, and that pediatrician basically separated mother and children and proceeded to inquire from the children about the issues that are probably sort of the ACEs type issue. In other words, were they around drugs, violence, sex, right. inappropriate family sexual behavior, and so on. And these kids came back very disconcerted, and that pediatrician was just young and just out of training. And the children reported to me that the pediatrician sat, stared into the computer, and went through lists of questions and didn't even look at them. And they walked out of there saying they were never going back and saying, can't they take the Fifth Amendment? And I believe that that pediatrician is probably just trying to do a good job and ask the questions that will allow the I to be dotted, the T to be crossed, so that they would be in compliance, so that they could appropriately bill and not get in trouble with the predatory auditors. And I believe that there's so much control that the system is broken. And if the people who are providing the work would just get paid for doing the work rather than trying to fight all the compliance issues, I believe we could spread the resources further and wider. And I know that there have got to be quotas, like how many people are screened. At least that's my impression. You've got to let your electronic medical record determine the number of screenings, and you've got to be in compliance. And I believe that everybody is just running scared trying to address the boogeyman, which is really our government. And if they would back away and let the experts take what little resources we have and efficiently apply them, I think our children would be so much better off.
All right. Thank you for the call. Those are good points, and maybe we can look at some of them later. But he's talking about letting best practice determine policy, right? I think that's what he's saying. If you're just tuning in to our program, my guest today is Dr. Michelle Laufer. We are discussing the challenges faced by Alaska Medicaid families in accessing psychological services. After the short break, we'll turn to our conversation. I'm Prentice Pemberton. This is Line 1, your health connection.
Funding for Line 1, your health connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning into the program, my guest today is Dr. Michelle Laufer with the Alaska Center for Pediatrics. Our subject today is Medicaid, kids, mental health, and really the problem of them accessing, I think, what is important and necessary services for their wellness. If you have a question or a comment, we can get you in the next 10 minutes or so. The Anchorage phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. I got a couple of emails here to read, but first we'll go back to the phones, and we'll take Tristan in Fairbanks. Go ahead. You're on Line 1.
Hi, I am a volunteer member for Interior Coalition for Perinatal Wellness in Fairbanks, and the subject of today's show is really moving for me because that is our main advocacy issue for the coalition. We focus on perinatal wellness, so the mother, but it, obviously in regards there, the kids are a unit with the mom.
Right.
So what works for the mom works for the kids. And Gunnar actually touched on what one of my main questions was in calling in regarding what was happening legislatively in regards to movement to make changes to the Medicaid codes so that other providers like nurse practitioners and family counselors can provide services other than medication. They can provide some type of therapeutic, you know, service that works for their scope of practice. So I think, you know, if I guess if that's where we're at, where there's, you know, the main block is a lobbying issue that saddens me, but I hope that, you know, there's a lot of movement to make changes, and it's such an important issue. So I really think at some point we're really going to overpower that lobby and make the changes that need to be made. So.
Do you want to speak about the legislation that you're aware of?
Well, thank you for that work you do, Tristan. So my husband, he's a family doc, and he went to dinner one time with a healthcare insurance executive who described, you know, healthcare money as a bunch of money in a bathtub. And it's the role of the insurance company, or in this case, Medicaid, the state, to basically clog the drain and not let the money flow out of the bathtub. And I'm concerned that some of the regulations around Medicaid for healthcare, specifically the one that requires a psychiatrist in the building 30% of the time, is sort of clogging the drain, because other insurances find Prentice and his peers perfectly capable of providing care without the oversight of a psychiatrist 30% of the time. So there are, first of all, my understanding is that at any time that particular law regarding the psychiatrist's presence in the building could be removed. That's a state law that's specific to Alaska. I could be wrong. Someone let me know if that's wrong. There is a bill, and I don't know if this is one that's being held up, but there's Senate Bill 169, which will allow an MD to supervise a therapist for 10 sessions a year for a patient. So that will allow, for instance, my office could potentially bill for Jessica's work to Medicaid if she's sort of supervised by myself. No, it's not clear what that supervision means, what the requirements are for the clinic. There are going to be a lot of, you know, as I see them, ways to clog the drain. There are going to be a lot of ways to make it hard for clinics to comply and participate. But my hope would be that those could be as minimal as possible so that, you know, primary care clinics can provide behavioral health, you know, in the office, which for many conditions is appropriate, not all. So that I am aware of the possibility of eliminating that 30% law, and B, the Senate Bill 169. And I know Prentice, you're aware of another one with regards to counselors.
Yeah, Senate Bill 105, which was, I believe, what Gunnar was talking about, which was sponsored by Senator Wilson, said it was proposing, and I believe it passed, at least that's my knowledge, that LMFTs, which are licensed and marital family therapists, be permitted to see Medicaid clients without psychiatric supervision. That was designed to unclog some of the drain, as you speak. But the problem is that there's only 70, I think 73 of them in Alaska, of the LMFTs. And what's interesting, and this is what I did not know, and I don't know what Gunnar's talking about, of the LPCs and the LCSWs being approved as well, because it was only LMFTs on that, on Senate Bill 105. But their training is essentially the same as LPCs and LCSWs. It's a little different focus, marriage and family dynamics versus systems theory, right, for LCSWs. But systems theory is family. So it's similar training, similar qualifications. And all accepted by other insurances other than Medicaid. So, yes, Tristan, I hope that answers some of your questions. It seems like there's a whole bunch of people in this state kind of pushing up on this bubble, and it feels like we're getting pushed back down, kind of like, no, it's too much money. And I keep coming back to the money. Mm-hmm. If we serve 30% of the kids in Alaska on Alaska Medicaid who need services based on the statistics, if you extrapolate them, depending on what they need, it will be an expense, but we have to consider the expense of jails, institutional care.
Yeah,
every
it's a
time.
Downstream issue. If we're not helping mothers through postpartum depression, then we're going to be helping their children through anxiety issues regarding, you know, feelings of disconnect from a mother relationship, possibly, you know, down the road. You know, it's not going to go away. So.
Yeah, and we also increase, you know, the risk of family violence, which leads children into the OCS world, you know, of which a statistic I heard last weekend was that, you know, 30% of kids under the age of 8 have had contact with OCS. And, you know, 30% of kids in Alaska by the time they're 8 have had contact. Now, they're not all screened in, but there's some report. And that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tristan, thanks. If this is the Lori I know, but I think it is, then she probably knows the answer to the legislation stuff. Go ahead, Lori, you're on line one.
Hi, Prentice. I'm Lori Houston, and I'm practicing in the Valley, and I've been for about 25 years now.
And you were on on line one. Yes, a while ago. You were a guest on line one, and we talked about pediatric therapy.
I was.
It was great.
About how to get your children into therapy and how to recognize when they need it and what play therapy is. So my question is just to follow up and get some clarification that LMSTs have been approved.
Yeah.
And now that other licensed clinicians. And is Medicaid doing anything about the reimbursement rate and the systems to just keep records and documents so that you can avoid audit and all of those other pieces that sort of clog the drain, so to speak? Or are practitioners going to have to develop systems in place that can alleviate those challenges that would keep a private practitioner from wanting to see kids with Medicaid?
Yes, those are all good questions, and you bring up a good point. So besides the arduous work of the extra hour for every hour you see a client of Medicaid paperwork, they also want to pay you cents on the dollar, right? That's the...
Exactly.
And then we have to look from the macro perspective, like budgetary restrictions. Like we all agree we need to educate our kids well and provide them with mental health services, but how do we pay for it, I guess? I don't know.
But even if each practitioner could open up 2 or 3 slots on their caseload to support, it may alleviate the 6 to 12 month waiting list that we experience out here in the Valley for Medicaid families. But,
yes, I would agree with
that's the answer.
I agree with Gunnar and you that if they opened up LCSWs, my clinic could take 10% Medicaid and take a chunk, and his clinic could take Medicaid, and your clinic could take Medicaid, and we could all take a load of this and take less money because we understand the limitations and serve and make our community healthier. So.
But is there anybody that's a practitioner that's helping the state to be able to develop policies to support this? Like, is there somebody from the mental health community that's working with the state to come up with a system that would work for the state of Alaska's children?
Yes. Yes, I don't know. Yes, that's a great question. And yes, that should be happening. And yes, I will call Medicaid. They are on my list of people to invite to come into the program to talk about this and figure out how they're making their policies. And if they'll come on, that'd be great.
That would be beautiful.
And then we can hopefully get some answers and maybe find some solutions. So thanks for the call, Lori, and the work you're doing.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
And you know, Prentice, I think we talked about earlier that there is some new, and I do not understand it, but somehow United Healthcare is going to be in some way managing Medicaid, and has made a promise of saving the state quite a bit of money. And so I would wonder, you know, I mean, that would be another person to, you know, another group to reach out to if they're going to be managing Medicaid services.
Yeah, if my biller is listening to this and United Healthcare is going to take over, she's screaming no.
Well, right.
Because it's been a nightmare. I don't want to call them out, but like there's been a lot of difficulty with United Behavioral Health. I mean, maybe it's better. Maybe, and I should invite one of them on to discuss. I think that's a great point. I don't want to talk about them anymore. All right. So an email I want to read real quick. Hi, listening to your program, and I have a question. My son, who I suspect had ADHD or something, I now believe has high-functioning autism, and a statistic I've heard is that 1 in 48 males have this. Can you speak about this, by the way? I had him assessed in early middle school and was diagnosed with ADD, but I believe it was Asperger's instead. That's off topic, but not for you. I mean, how does she get the answer to that?
Well, again, my question would be, do you have Medicaid? So where I would start with that is, you don't mention how old your son is, but I would start at the pediatrician or your family doctor or whoever your healthcare provider is, and start there and figure out what the problems are. The other option would be at school, speaking with the counselor at your school if your son is in middle or high school. Sometimes they can point you in the right direction, but that depends a little bit on, again, age and what's been going on, and then insurance.
All right. Yeah, that's a great way to start. Do you have Medicaid or not? Because if you don't, then you can go get some help.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. All right. We're running up against the end of our show. Let's see. Because in light of increasing mental health related violence, I am forced to see access to mental health services as public health issues. I would like to know what is being done in the Alaska legislature to address this problem. To that end, I am copying this message to my own state representatives in the hope that one or both of them will be able to respond during the program. Well, unfortunately, they won't. But
well, I would say that is a really good point.
Yes.
If you care about this, please reach out to your representatives, because no matter your political affiliations, some of us come at this from more of a bleeding heart perspective,
humanistic
perspective, and some of us come at that sat look at the rates of violence and opiate use and substance use and car theft, and we're scared to walk in our town. I mean, some of us come at this from the perspective of, you know, we're afraid Alaska is becoming increasingly dangerous and there's more violent crime, and half of mental illness arises in children before the age of 14. And the earlier, once again, the earlier we can identify and help kids, the more we can divert from problems in teen years and such.
All right. That is the end. That's the music that says we're running up against the end of our show. Next week, Dr. Jay Butler returns for I'm Not Sure What. I didn't get his email this morning. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer for today's program. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.